Want to move down a little bit?
I wouldn't feel so far away.
Let's do it. Make him feel more comfortable.
Down to the middle row.
I gave a talk yesterday at the Unitarian Church of North Vancouver. I was joking with them. I can use my courtroom voice, but that would be better. So, thank you for that. It just all feels so distant. And it'd be good if we could just have more of a conversation about things.
Chris, by the way, there's no need for you to keep your mouth
on while
you're speaking.
I'm just about to
keep your head.
Nice to meet you all.
You haven't met yet, but...
No.
Yo, hello.
Where are you from?
I live in Lowell.
Oh, great. Okay. I hope you didn't come down just for this.
No.
No, good. Great. I got lost up there in Lillooet one time up meeting with clients. So, and what about yourself? You're in law school here too?
No, I'm just in
the
equity field,
worked
for YWCA.
Sorry?
Worked for YWCA.
Oh, YWCA. Oh, nice.
I'm a student. I'm an LLM student.
Oh, great. Oh, master student.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay. And I know both of you. I know you, and we've met. And yourself?
I'm PJ. I'm from Surrey. I'm a mom in Surrey. I'm low income, student.
Nice.
Just here.
Great. Well, thanks for coming out.
Yeah.
Thanks for. Okay. So maybe we'll just talk a little bit about these things. What I usually do is I give a couple of readings, little short ones, and then have a conversation. For those of you that have seen my little book, the best compliments I get are when people say, I really liked it, you didn't sound like a lawyer. So I'm like, hey, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I try to sound like a lawyer more when I'm in court, but when I write these things, why I did this was that I do, as Stepan say, I work in Aboriginal law. And I think a big part of it, like a lot of us, right, education and being part of that public discourse, really, really important. So I do a lot of that, and that's how I ended up with this. So the book is all short essays, 1,000 words or so. Don't try not to overextend my welcome and explain the law as best as possible, but then what I tend to do is, and I think the ones that work best, is I try to tell personal stories around the law, because I think that's one way to get to what you're trying to talk about.
Hey.
Because I get that all the time. I work just with First Nations, coast to coast. And we spend so much time them telling me their stories. I think there's a certain responsibility. Well, then, if I get the opportunity, I should share a little bit too, if that's a good way to do these things. So I thought I'd read just a couple. I'd do the first one, and then we can have a conversation about it. And the first one's about allies, because I'm sure a lot of you deal with allies for Indigenous people a lot, and I get asked a lot about how to be a good ally. I see that. So this piece I wrote is just how allyship can go off the rails. And one of the things that bothers me about allies sometimes, and I think it's important for them to have in mind when they're trying to be supportive of Indigenous people. So that's the first one. I'll read that one. And then the second one, about the Pope. And I thought it'd be a good chance to talk about the Pope a little bit. We all love to do that. So given what occurred last week, with the contingency that visited, and talk about the Pope and talk about the papal bulls and the doctrine of discovery, which I think goes exactly to your opening words stuck out. Like, it's just, what right do people have to be on Musqueam land? Right, so, okay. So, I'll just let you know this first one, I often have a hard time to read, because it is kind of personal, so. You know, just bear with me. I think I've read it at different events like 10 times, though, and I did this thing at the North Shore Church, the Unitarian Church in Vancouver yesterday, and it still broke me up. It still bothered me. So just a bit of context for where this comes from. I come across now, and I really work hard to come across as a total pencil neck geek, right? But if you knew me when I was 9 or 10, that's not where I come from, right? I was raised back in the bush in Manitoba. We ended up back there because we were displaced as part of the community. My dad died, left my mom with 8 kids, moved into an abandoned schoolhouse kind of thing. And I come from a large family, but I'm the only one to go to university. They're all smart, brilliant, but not this kind of intellectual geek type, right? And so when I grew up as a kid, it was very obvious, you know, we were from the right side of the tracks type of thing. So, and one of the things that I like to do is I like memorizing poetry, not mine, because I can't write good poetry. But I love people that can really write fantastic. So when I wrote this piece, I had this excerpt from a poem by Philip Levine in my head. So I'm just going to start with that. He knew the sadness of classrooms in December when the light fails early and the words on the blackboard abandon their grammar and sense, and then even their shapes, so that each letter points in every direction at once and means nothing at all. It's a beautiful poem called The Poem of Chalk. Okay, so this one's called Made of Sterner Stuff, The Problem with Allies. No. Just my thought. Allies depress me more than opponents. Many who outright disagree with me about respecting Indigenous rights are open to persuasion. I don't include the committed racists in this category. I'm talking about those whose opinions rest on a lack of information, context, and empathy. If I listen to them honestly and without judgment, they often do the same for me. When they realize I will not ridicule them for their old opinions, they become more receptive. They begin to acknowledge I might have a point. Maybe they should have a rethink. For example, several years ago, I spoke to a group of people in a resource extraction industry in Northern Ontario. As expected, I didn't have a warm welcome. For an hour and a half, I fielded questions and comments I hear on a regular basis. Why can't we all be treated equally? Indians don't pay taxes. Don't your clients want to work? After explaining that my clients do in fact pay taxes, that they are the hardest working people I know, and why all Canadians should be proud the Constitution protects collective rights, many, but not all, began to reconsider their opinions. By the end of the session, their hostility had been replaced by friendliness and a greater understanding of the legal and historical context based on recognizing Indigenous rights. I left the session exhausted. It was very tiring, but hopeful. In contrast, allies can move me to tears. I'm not referring to the vast majority who are well-intentioned and committed to doing their best. I'm not even referring to the minority who indulge in performative allyship. I'm sure you've met a few of those. They are easily recognizable and increasingly find themselves without an audience. The people I have in mind are the allies who are perfectly suited to be cast as judges in a game show called Defend Your Life. Usually well-educated and comfortably white, buoyed and insulated by entitlement and privilege, they rush forward with opinions, criticisms, and superior insights, unburdened by doubt or humility. I often encounter these people when my criticism touches their core understanding of what it means to be Canadian. On the second anniversary of the acquittal of the Saskatchewan farmer who killed Colton Bushy, I gave a talk to a group of allies about the systemic violence perpetrated against Indigenous people by non-Indigenous Canadians. It was a difficult talk to give. Professionally, I had just witnessed the RCMP's arrest of my Wet'suwet'en. Personally, it's third memories of growing up in rural Manitoba. At the end of the talk, an ally rushed forward to challenge me. The nub of his rebuttal was, Indians killed Indians before the white men arrived. Looking around the room, I noticed one of Colton's cousins, eager to speak to me, but blocked by this domineering ally. I struggled to distance myself from him and to contain my emotions. If some of you know my wife, she actually stepped in. I thought I was going to lose it. I was being corrected, put in my place by a white man, confident not just in his opinions, but in his right, and from his perspective, his obligation to school me. I felt myself back in grade school, a kid without privilege, confident in my family's support, but constantly reminded of my position on the margins of respectability. At some point in high school, I realized questioning had limits. A line existed between acceptable, polite criticism and the unspeakable. The national myth of Canada the good was sacrosanct. Cross the line and you risk being disciplined, punished, and cast out. Some allies do even more than act as self-appointed arbiters. They strive to establish themselves as stronger and more determined than those they purport to support. 2 days after news emerged of the bodies of 215 Indigenous children discovered at the Kamloops Indian Residential School, I was about to sit down for dinner with my family, knowing that clients, friends, and family members across the country were struggling with loss and grief. I was engulfed in a fog of sadness. Unthinkingly, I opened the email on my phone. Waiting for me was an email in reply to an essay I had published 9 months before. The writer was a self-described member of a well-known national nonprofit organization dedicated to dismantling racism and colonization. The tragic news from Kamloops had motivated him to reach out to me. He had a problem with the use of my word acceptance. In the second last paragraph of my essay that I had written, where I had written, the first step is acceptance. Acceptance that Canada is fundamentally a racist state. In his view, I should have used acknowledge, because the word, quote, is made of sterner stuff. For my edification, he helpfully included dictionary definitions. I had never cried in front of my kids, but in that moment, slumped over the table with my head in my hands, I cried. I cried for the 215 children and their families. I cried for all the stolen, abused, and murdered Indigenous children across Canada. I cried for my lack of words to explain any of this to my children. And I cried for the marginalized, oppressed, and abused whose voices are stolen and silenced by their allies. I always have a hard time to read that one. But I think it's an important conversation about, you know, how do you act as a good ally? And I really do find it frustrating. I've talked to a few of my colleagues about this. You know, I don't know what it is with some people, but they want to show that they're even tougher and more resilient than the people they're trying to support. So, yeah, I just, any thoughts about that one? Or?
Do you think it's just insecurity or fear that that kind of response? I'm not in any way.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that comes from. It's like a competitiveness.
I'm smiling because Bruce knows competitiveness.
Yeah. But it's this. It's to. I don't know, I think allyship can become a form of colonization all over again, right?
Sorry, I think what Ancestral Voices wrote about it, a friend of mine, Sachin Kanish,
Yeah. She
said, we want accomplices, not allies.
Exactly.
Sachin Kanish, a person from a Housing Nation on the island, and also, active in correcting some of the mistakes that happened in around Berry Creek is still happening sometimes with environmentalist white settlers allies trying to help out Indigenous territory, but also not respecting Indigenous leadership, and that happens over and over again in the movements, and the movements are riven with debates that are fueled often by Canada and its colonialist bastards who are really pumping up like right-wing movements to come and attack us.
Yeah.
You're not really getting your audience here, though. This is not like
allyship.
Like this person
that.
Is like
no.
Folks are in serious struggle, and everywhere are in serious. Like you alluded to the Wet'suwet'en, and that's where we're at. And so I think that we're at the situation now where, when sabotage comes down and the cops are coming for people, what are we going to do? Are we accomplices, or are we like getting brownie points for allyship? So. Yeah.
I think that's an important question, because I get all kinds of people, how can we support?
Well, right? but often the answer is like, send money.
What's the answer? What? Send money.
Send money, like really, realistically, if you're like middle class white settler who doesn't want to involve their family in any sort of thing, like you also said that you had trouble talking to your kids. I too struggle to talk to my teenagers about this burden of what is going on here, but I think it's really important that you do figure out a way to talk to your kids about
it. Yeah, I do. So I've got some pieces in there about the WIMS. So could we represent the Unistone and dark house? So I've got some pieces in there about the violence against them. Mm-hmm. What does it take to be a good ally then? Like you're saying, don't be an ally, be an accomplice. Any more thoughts on that?
I just mentioned that one of the things that I find is that people want to be right. And they're unable to say, hey, I was wrong about that. Maybe we can do it a different way. Hmm. People are uncomfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's what I seem to see quite a bit. Which is totally fair enough, right? So as Anne just mentioned earlier, like maybe people are insecure, right? So I think sometimes it's insecurity that drives that.
Insecurity and not knowing and not being willing to know or to listen.
Yeah.
Or think they're listening.
Or think they're listening.
Yeah, listening. But I mean, one of the, I think that's one of the issues is the humanity piece, that we all have insecurities. And if people are able to say, oh my gosh, how can I help? And your decision that you're going to make may not be something that I would make, but help by helping make the decision just by supporting or communicating or advocating. Because that's the other thing, is that if people actually really believe in self-determination, then there'd be some decisions that have been made that environmentalists and others wouldn't like.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, I would look at the Delmo case, the whole parking lot reference.
Yeah.
Oh, parking lot is not sort of synonymous with Aboriginal title.
Yeah.
Like, who are you to say?
Yeah.
If the nation has always had that place as a meeting place, and in 2022, now we have to put it as concrete so people can drive their cars there. How
that's
is that not similar? Anyway, that's kind of it drives me crazy too.
Should it have to be similar?
I think one of the points that I was trying to get at was that you get a lot of people that are well-intentioned and that see themselves as real good social justice types, non-Indigenous people. And until you poke them too much. Like, some of them, you poke them in a sensitive place. And this whole idea, and maybe it's a different generation, but this Canada the Good idea is something that is really hard. So when they see and you tell them the story of what occurred with the RCMP moving against the Unistoten with this militarized force, you know, and you think about that compared to what happened with the convoy in Ottawa and the disconnect, they just don't, a lot of people don't want to accept that. That's what I find. They want to be an ally, but it can't go to the point where it questions their idea of Canada.
Like Sachin says, everybody wants to be an ally until it's time to do some real allies.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like,
then
you have
to get arrested.
Wait a minute. I don't want to do that.
But that's just defensive privilege, and that's just
that.
What Canada is fake. Canada is just a resource extraction company. It's not, I'm sorry, all of you setting to be lawyers, but you're on the wrong side, and you're defenders of privilege, and that's what the RCMP is, the armed, like, they need to keep their monopoly on violence, so that's what the law...
I was going to get a t-shirt made up saying something like, if reconciliation's making you feel good, you're doing it wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know? Because that's a lot of it. It makes people feel good,
mm-hmm.
what they're doing, so...
So why are you saying how to fix it? This is the title of your book. I'm sorry to be sort of snarky about it, but
I don't think that's snarky.
Why fix it? If it's that broken.
And switch.
Reconciliation. It's a sham. People are saying, like, I'm just handing out postcards that say, reconciliation is dead. The RCMP shot Jared Lowndes. This is Laura Holland's Wet'suwet'en man who was killed by RCMP executing a warrant at Campbell River last July 8th. So on the 8th of every month, we've been going back to the RCMP and reminding them that you executed this man just on on the search for a warrant. They sent in dogs against him, and if you defend yourself against a dog, it's assault police. So they shot him for defending himself against a police dog and killed him at 9 a.m. in the morning. Anyway, I went with his mother last week to the investigations office and got the bloody clothes back. And let me tell you, the government is really dragging their feet on this investigation, and so many of these deaths that you're talking about, they're dragging their feet on this, and they're hiding their culpability for this. So how do you, you know, defend or advance reconciliation when it's dead? It's clearly dead.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about that a little bit. I've been talking about that the last week around the visit to see the Pope, right? So my view on this is just this whole thing with reconciliation, and this is, if you look at it through what the politicians say and what the Canadian courts say, is basically it's impossible. And why it's impossible is because when they talk about reconciliation, what are they trying to reconcile? They're trying to reconcile a right, with is the pre-existing rights of Indigenous people, their inherent rights in the land, with a lie that somehow colonizers can just show up and displace Indigenous sovereignty and acquire an interest over the land. Like from a legal perspective and from a political one, that's why it doesn't work.
Yep.
Because how can you do this? And now, of course, in Canada, we don't talk about it usually in that context. The way it's done in Canadian courts, they don't say doctrine of discovery. They say assertion of crown sovereignty. This is a Canadian euphemism for the doctrine of discovery. We just don't like using it. And instead, they say assertion of crown sovereignty. So when they say reconcile, they say you've got to reconcile the pre-existing inherent rights of Indigenous people to the assertion of crown sovereignty, which is basically Captain Vancouver came sailing into English Bay, Captain Cook, Nootka Sound, and somehow, poof, Indigenous sovereignty is displaced, and the Queen, the Crown, acquires an underlying interest in the land. So I think fundamentally that's where it's, how can you do that? And that's why, at least for my clients, a lot of them, they just won't even have that conversation. It's become a fourth letter word. But that's, I think there's a lot of disconnect still with the courts about that, with politicians, because politicians think they're doing a good thing, reconciling. But how can you do that?
Lip service.
Well, it does become a lot of rhetoric. And the problem with rhetoric is that it can encourage cynicism.
It's already done so.
I know, but don't worry. I work all across the country. I see it.
I'm worried. More than worried.
And then people really get turned off. Like, why would you even start the conversation? So, did you have some thoughts about that too? I see you.
Me?
Down your mask. Yeah.
Oh, I was just kind of thinking about the demographics and the people you're talking to and the people that you exist with in that legal arena.
Yeah.
And you talk about allies, and you talk about. How do we fix this with reconciliation? You're talking about those two different things there, and I think that where we fall apart is we don't really define what we expect from different demographics of allies. Where, you know, you're talking to students, you possibly students here, that their allyship and their commitments as allies could be a little more, you know, constrained than say the big INAC chiefs meetings that you go to and talk to, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of money flying around in that room. They all control $5-10 million budgets. So those are, you know, you're talking about going in there as a different kind of ally as opposed to coming in here and leading legal thoughts positions or existing legal positions. And I think that's where we're breaking down, because when you talk to this kind of demographic, maybe you should be talking about the real legal challenges that are existing in place. And I think you alluded to the fact that you're a constitutional lawyer and you work with Delgamuukw, you work with Dark House, you work with Netabees and you know, these other people up there. And I've asked right on live television, I can't remember her name, Delay? I think her name's Delay. And I asked her, about, this was at the union office last 2 years ago, and I asked her about Delgamuukw too. And I have a history of asking about Delgamuukw too. Back in 1998, Herb George came to Williams Lake, to the Longhouse, and he was in there, and he was just right on point with his rhetoric about Delgamuukw. At that time, it was 6 months old, the decision. And he was talking about how this decision, it meant so many different things for the people. But I think that the problem was that his allies, his legal allies, weren't really pointing him in the proper direction there. Because at that time, he was saying that to go back to court, because this is only a decision, it's not a ruling, there's a big difference. Decisions send it back to the lower courts, and rulings change Canadian law, in a nutshell, is what I understand. So why go back to the community and say we won this, they admitted Aboriginal title, but yet at the same time, if you fought it as a ruling and you challenged the statutes of law that are in existence today as a legal ally, that's where we're kind of falling apart, because we don't have a Delgamuukw too, and we haven't had one in 25 years, and we have a lot of legal scholars going around talking about how they're going to do something about reconciliation, but yet they failed to incorporate the basic elements of constitutional law in Delgamuukw, which is the strongest, from my understanding anyway, one of the strongest legal cases that have gone through. Chilcotin and
the Calder case and Sparrow case.
Those are before, though. I'm only talking about Delgamuukw and
yeah.
Delgamuukw and Haida when it was passed down in 04, you know, and then you get to Chilcotin in 07,
yeah.
Or sorry, 14. Sorry, 14.
Call into force and effect.
And I see that the problem. When we talk about reconciliation and we want to grab onto one thing legally, we have two issues before us right now. We have Delgamuukw 2 and we have Coastal GasLink and Dark House and Unistoten. And we have reconciliation with the Pope. We have two major cash grabs there. If you don't understand Native politics, these are cash grabs. Okay, we haven't spoken as a nation in the Shuswap Nation about what we're going to do about residential schools. We haven't done that. But yet we have a delegation that goes to Europe and speaks on the Shuswap Nation's behalf. So where we're really failing is in our legal allyship. And that's one of the things, that's why I'm here today. That's why I came here today, to talk about these things. And this Delgamuukw too, you know, I asked Herb George back in 1998, when are you gonna take this back to court for Delgamuukw too and just get an outright, you own the land, change the Canadian law, The problem with that is it basically, I think in a legal context, it breaks up Canada and they can't have that. It just can't be done.
Well, they,
in Canada's, yeah. In Canada's prerogative, they can't do that. So we have these lawyers that kind of gently steer us away from Delgamuktu and jurisdiction and international rule of law of ownership and usurpation of jurisdiction. Treason, fraud.
That's what it is.
The legal context. The legal context treason. of those specific issues. They don't not need to be land. Litigated. They just need to be addressed.
No crown land.
You already have. You said it right here. This stolen Musqueam land. We all know it. So my question, Bruce, is. To what degree are the legal people advocating for a Delgamuuk too? And we can put it in another context as well. Because on March 8th, 10th, 2002, the lawyers danced a writ out of the summit. I don't know if you know what the summit is. It's a meeting place of all of the treaty bands and the treaty process in North Vancouver every 3 months. And there was a big hoopla, there was a big ceremony, there was a big send-off for that document that day. And Gujar and Terry Lynn.
Yeah.
It was the most sacred, holiest of documents that day. And she was saying, it's a great honor to take this out of here. And she was shaking. I'm taking this to be admitted in the court registry on behalf of the Haida Nation, right? I asked Gujar, he came to Kamloops in 16, and I asked him, you guys started the title case, the statement of claim. I seen that. I said, that's the best one I've ever seen. What are you guys doing with that? And he's like, oh, we don't feel we need to do that anymore. I was like, what? That'd be like you challenging ownership of your house and you get halfway through the fight. And you submit all the legal documents, and then you turn around and say, oh, I don't want that house anymore. That's what I kind of seen him as doing. And I'm like, what? Like, I've read some of these legal documents, and I believe that Gujar's 2002 statement of claim, his flora and fauna statement of claim for Haida Gwaii was the best that I've ever seen. And I still believe that to this day. I still believe that. I believe that should be the low water mark for what our lawyers are doing today. I've talked to some constitutional lawyers, and one lawyer out of Ottawa, he says, every time a Native person goes to court, it should be a constitutional challenge. They don't have the right to impose their jurisdiction on you in an unceded territory. The flavor of the day in British Columbia right now is reconciliation and stolen land and acknowledgement of these stolen lands. That's my thoughts.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Those are all good thoughts.
Good thoughts, eh?
They're thoughts that carry me around this country.
Okay, some of my thoughts on this, because this whole legitimacy of so-called crown land and the assertion of crown sovereignty, all this stuff, right? My view of it is that when it's been argued, because it has been at the Supreme Court, so when they heard Chilcotin, there were a lot of arguments to the courts basically saying, you know, this is just a big lie.
Yeah, I've this seen those books of authorities, I have, yeah, and they don't go far enough back, right?
And so what I've seen the court do in that situation is basically say, sorry, it's like you got an old car and the engine is hammering away, but they won't open up the hood. Because what the court has said is that if we question the doctrine of discovery, it would question our own authority to make any of these decisions. Because the Supreme Court's authority is based on this assertion of crown sovereignty. And so they won't even go there.
No, their assertion of jurisdiction is based on the August 2nd, 1858 Queen Anne's Act of British Columbia. That's where they get their power from. And we don't have legal lawyers in this province challenging the BC Act of 1858.
What are your thoughts on that, Stephen?
I'm not sure which act you're referring
August
to.
August 2nd, Queen Anne signed it herself saying that you can have BC, right? In direct contravention to her own great-grandfather, King George's royal proclamation, right? That we were to remain unmolested and undisturbed in these unceded territories. That's right there in her great-grandfather's proclamation, right? And when she signed the BC Act of 1858, she completely negated the rule of law when she did that.
So Calder went through a lot of the Gold Fields Act, the Land Title Act, all these things, right?
I don't know that.
In detail. And that's where it got to the court Calder in 1976, saying, you know what, when we look at all this, we don't see where there's any authority, or there's a definite question that there was any authority to do any of this. Because if there are pre-existing rights in the land, where did the Crown get authority to start handing out these certificates of indefeasible title and say that it's your land and it's the Crown land? So that's been central. They're questioning it, and the court's gone as far as saying, yeah, there are these pre-existing rights. And then we got this assertion of Crown sovereignty. But what I see is the court won't say what that means then. Right? This part about they won't question it. That's why I thought one thing that could be done is that the government, the federal government, could pass a piece of legislation.
See, that's why I want to talk to the legal scholars who are our allies, and what are you exactly advising our INAC chiefs on? You know? That's my question, because when you look at the Book of Authorities for all of these court cases, there's no BC Act in there. It's not challenged. And it's the one act that gives you title in this province. Right? The treaties are something different. I'm not talking about treaties. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not totally not talking about treaties. Those are other, other instances of embezzlement that I don't even want to get into, and coercion. But that's what I don't see, is our legal people advising our chiefs into what arguments to put forward. And you know, Herb George, back in 1998, he said, it's going to take us 2 years to prepare for a return to court with Delgamuukw. And since 2000, I've been saying, well, we would have been 22 years into Delgamuukw 2 right now. And I asked Ellen LaFond, you know her? And she just shit on me when I asked that question in that press conference. And she had talked to me like I was a little kid, and I didn't like that. And that to me, that's part of the allies that are taking our leaders astray. They're taking them down that non-Canadian, or the non-challenge of Canadian jurisdiction, the legal ownership. And you always got to think back to a house, you know, the age-old analogy of a house. And that one's just been beat to death about, you know, it's our house. And the only way that I can expand on that is we're being kept in the unfinished bathroom downstairs in our own house, and it's the chiefs who are the gatekeepers. And once a day, they let us out to go enjoy the living room. And then they put us back in the unfinished bathroom downstairs, the reservations.
So true. Have you read Bev Sellers' book? Price Page.
There's a video of me and Bev Sellers in Soda Creek, and she's assaulting and kicking my wife's car. I don't even want to talk about her.
Well, she wrote a good book about the house.
Yeah. I know of many other publications I'd spend my time reading in terms of legalese, you know, and
what about the Pope? What did you all think of the Pope's?
Well, I think that as soon as he admitted...
Let's just see what the rest of the people think, too, of the Pope's apology. I want to put it in quotes, which kind of signals what I thought of it, but... Any thoughts on what the Pope said last week?
It wasn't an apology.
Sorry?
It wasn't an apology. It's I mean, the Catholic Church will not take responsibility as the Church. It's members of the Catholic Church. It's rogue people always. It's not the institution. It will never take responsibility.
Right. So there's a difference between saying individuals and the Church as a entity.
Did he even talk about the Doctrine of Discovery?
No, no, not that I saw.
Some regretful incidents of some individuals.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of the thing. What about the rest of you? He's gone further in other situations, didn't he? When he was in Ireland, talk about the Church being involved in a crime?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. My family's actually Irish.
So
we were talking a little bit before the Pope had issued his apology. We were talking about like what might be the holdup. But yeah, I mean, pretty much as others have said, one, it's way too late. And two, it's not really, there's no taking of accountability really on behalf of the Church.
I think it would be important to say, you know, the Church as an institution, but has been complicit in genocide. Court and
reparations.
Yeah, and then to say, and then they owe a whole bunch of money that the Church doesn't pay up.
Well, that's what's happening right now. That's what I said. That's a big cash grab going over there by the chiefs. And that's exactly what we're living right now. They are making reparations, but it's only this much when we're owed. I can't reach that high.
But there's an outstanding bill the Catholic Church here in Canada owes, what is it, 25 million or something?
Yeah, they haven't paid their...
They've not paid it.
And the problem with that is that each of the... They separate themselves out into corporations.
Right.
So that's why. Is each, you know, one might say, oh, we, you know, apologize or we say whatever, but it's not going to necessarily be...
they don't take responsibility
not as a Vatican itself. So that's what people have been talking about, bringing a case against the Vatican itself to get at everybody, not just the individual diocese
or whatever.
I think that's where we lose our legal guidance again. I think you all need to, I know that I heard people talk about genocide is not allowed in Canada, the charges or something like that. We're not talking about the state of Canada here. We're talking about international, you know, the one world order that everybody aspires for, the peace and prosperity under a one world order, right? Well, this genocide, you have to look it up in the international context, and what does it say in there? It says when you take children out of one group and you put them in another group specifically for bringing about that first group's existence, that's genocide. And our legal expertise in Canada aren't advising our leaders on our native leaders on that and how to go after genocide and challenge. Somehow, where is the framework to get to an international stage in this question?
Yeah, she's got a good, she's got all that.
And we've actually had her come and do a book talk.
Because if any one of us,
who is here?
The other day, if any one of us would have said, geez, I'm sorry for those thousands of children that you found, somebody would have been there waiting to take us away in handcuffs.
It's true.
If there was thousands of children found on your corporation's grounds, If Elon Musk or any Zuckerberg, anybody else said, sorry about those 1,000 dead Chinese children there. They came over, we brought them over, you know, or those East Indians and, you know, all these people of color. Well, then that's genocide. And we're not, and I know this because I've watched the chiefs. I've watched the Chiefs. You can see it in my... And I want to say something else before I leave here, too, is that this lady behind me, her name's PJ, and she's the one that did that website for me. It's really in its basic form right now. It's really in its most basic form right now, but it's... I believe that it's something that, that good will come from it. So that issue of genocide is in there. It's in there. And talking about, you know, it's they took our children. And they admitted many times to kill the Indian in us.
They had cattle cars. They put kids in cattle cars.
There's a picture from Williams Lake and it shows our children in cattle cars.
They took them.
That's right from where I come from. That picture is taken right there on a road to St. Joseph's Mission.
This is recent history. People are still alive, and the church won't give up the names. Like, there's just not enough anger at all around this.
Yeah.
But you know, what do I know about that? I don't know. I know that right now I'm going to pick up my wife, and she's coming back from Rome, Italy right now. And that's why I came here, is because it was on the way to the airport. That's why I came here today.
And what are her views? Have you talked to
her? No, wife? I wanted to...
wait till she gets back?
I wanted her to fly on her own, and I haven't talked to her all week. And I did actually a little bit, but just to say hi and... I wanted her to fly on her own and deal with her own nation politics. So.
Yeah, because we just see the news reports.
But she did, in January, she did put out a notice in her community saying that she was going to be going to Rome, Italy, and that she wanted to have a discussion on it, and all Statlium people were allowed to come there. She did have that discussion. She did create that venue and that avenue for her nation to deal with the issue of residential schools within her nation. Whereas myself, I come from the Shuswap Nation, and I can say that neither Kamloops or Williams Lake, the two places where the residential schools were found, on the Kamloops Band and the Williams Lake Band, they won't have any discussion at a nation level in regards to what needs to happen in regards to these residential school issues and how we're going to deal with it at a nation level. We're not doing that, whereas opposed to, like I said, in the Statlium Nation, my wife has put out those notices, and she's been updating people from Rome when she was over there. I really tried to stay out of it just so that I wouldn't influence it. I do say that... genocide, there is no statute of limitations for genocide, you know, so they're guilty of it today. They're guilty of it today, and all his heirs.
And so the book I mentioned by Tamara, she's an alumna from this school, and she works now at the Native Education College, and she did a book called Suffer the Little Children, and it's basically, she goes through the whole international law definition, and she says, this is genocide. Because it's always cultural genocide that we hear, right?
Yeah. So I'm really familiar. Super friends was there at several of her launches, organized book launches for that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm trying to tell your friend.
He knows. But
so there are those arguments there, how you make them, where you make them, who is...
She was suppressed so hard by the system, though, just to get to that stage of getting her doctorate. And you know how difficult it was for her? Mm-hmm. You should ask her about it. The length of time it took her to publish that book and what personal responsibilities, you know, she's had to take to just get that to that stage of publication. And that's not taking it. So I'm, I guess, asking my comrade here, what about The Hague? And what about this supposed UNDRIP, you know, new thing? It says in there that they're supposed to actually have full prior informed consent. That phrase is in there, full prior and informed consent. And yet they're just coming in, and it seems to be facts on the ground, and they set up these media exclusion zones, push the witnesses and allies back as far as they can, and arrest everybody in the lockdown area violently. And that's, I saw it at Anita Place, I saw it at Camp Cloud, at Trans Mountain, I saw it at Maple Ridge, several other instances, and then they pulled the same thing at Wet'suwet'en territory, and it just keeps happening. So how, at what point, like, Yeah. How do we enforce this Canada's fate and has no jurisdiction and wants to avoid arguing that in court? Like, even you get to the point where we do raise the doctrine of discovery in court, like even some people have tried recently, and it just things just sometimes they'll just drop the charges against people so as not to have to
deal with it. Yeah. Well, my view on the UNDRIP legislation is that the fundamental problem with it is that whether it reads this way or not, the way the provincial and federal governments view it is that it's an aspirational document.
Yeah,
and we're committing to doing something in the future, changing the laws to bring them in line. And there's two problems with that. One, and a perfect example, is Unistoten and the Coastal GasLink, is that the provincial government's been clear, their position is, we already made the decision before we passed the legislation. So, sorry, that was before.
Yeah.
I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and probably more fundamentally, in BC, the way they look at the legislation is that it's about us changing the laws down the road. But if you read their legislation, I think it's fair to interpret it as every time you make a decision now, whether it's a law, a regulation, an ordered council, it has to be in line with UNDRIP.
Yeah.
But that's not the position they've been taking on it. I don't know what, it's frustrating because it does exactly the opposite of what they said they're going to do. And then it gives them a shield because it's a way to shut up people. They can say, hey, what are you complaining about, man? We got our UNDRIP legislation. We've got our 92-point plan or whatever they're calling it this week, right? And so it's a way to silence people, is to say we're doing something when they're not actually doing it.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating, and it's actually very refreshing to hear anger about these topics.
Oh, we try to say things and to be clear and to be honest about things,
but you kind of have to stop yourself at a certain level. I try just to be honest about things, but
yeah.
The reality is that anger is not encouraged, and it's unfortunate because it's people, so you say people's lives, people are dying and have died, and generational changes have to be made. So there's.
Well, I think with UNDRIP, I've seen the same thing with the Forest Stewardship Council, the principles, the international principles that came out of Oaxaca, Mexico in 1999, somewhere around there, 98, 2000. And they had these international principles about how if you're going to buy FSC wood, then we're going to provide a chain of custody for you to show that this was harvested properly in the indigenous territory where it was authorized by these indigenous people that operated in conjunction with us to harvest according to these principles. And what the Forest Stewardship Council done was that took that international declaration and it prostituted it down to a band level in Canada where it was the First Nation that gave authorization for any FSC certification at that time, and we were the only ones. Williams Lake Band was the only one that did FSC, and I went up there to Rod Blakes and I asked him, and he said, well, it was actually Lynn Gilbert, the natural resource worker, that signed off on this for FSC certification for us. Don't get me wrong, he had a good woodlot and everything there he was harvesting under, and he was getting his wood FSC certified through Herb Hammond down in Winlaw in the Kootenays. And the same people that were involved in watering down the Forest Stewardship Council are the same people who are involved in watering down the UNDRIP.
Yeah.
And they admitted it. They've admitted it. They admitted that, I developed UNDRIP. You know, well, I also watched you, I just watched you just slash to pieces the Forest Stewardship Council and the international principles. And now UNDRIP is the same way, because UNDRIP is being spoke of in a hereditary chief's context, whereas it's been watered down again to give authority to the individual Indian Act bands in any given territory where they want UNDRIP implemented, right? And that's where the Dark House situation is in it's in conflict, because Dark House is not, it's a hereditary system, and it's the I can't remember the name of that reserve there. Witset? Morristown. Morristown. They're against the occupation there in Dark House territory, but see, those are the two, the INAC, the UNDRIP going to the INAC Indians, and the UNDRIP being affecting the traditional Indians, because Netabis and all those guys there, and they're all fighting it as a traditional government up there, right? So we're not having that differentiation of what UNDRIP means to do two different groups of Indians, and that's what I mean. You have to understand Native politics in order to have some kind of contextual understanding of what's being discussed here. And Native politics is so corrupt, it's not funny, and it's shown in that website, the actual documents, right?
Can I jump in? Because we're getting close to the end of time.
Me too, because my parking is both done. And I was going to run.
Okay, don't let him park again. You're faster.
So I just wanted to say, I find it really valuable what we've heard from you, the both of you today. Thank you. And if I could try and just sort of summarize really briefly, you feel that lawyers in the legal profession have failed you, have failed your nations, and have failed your chiefs, and the chiefs and councils have also failed you in certain ways, and that...
Well, they're both part of the same hypocrisy.
So, you would want something different or something more from the lawyers and legal professions who are advising. And I wanted to just give Bruce a chance to respond on that point. I think Bruce, as much as or more than any other lawyer in Canada, is devoting his career to providing advice to Indigenous peoples that that would be useful, that would not fail them. And just wonder what you...
I do what I can, but I'm not shy about... What?
I learned a lot from Bruce Clark.
Yeah, I've got his kinds now. Yeah, they were joking with me. The last lawyer we had named Bruce, he was hauled out in handcuffs. So, yeah. But it is a difficulty. I want to just acknowledge a difficulty in the legal profession. It is a difficulty. What you're talking about, it is.
I know that it's legal political suicide. Yeah. I understand that.
No, no, but it's just.
But
that it's
some hard. Of them, some people have to make that commitment. Yeah. That's no, all. You know, like, what kind of ally are you?
Yeah.
Right?
All goes back to your own personal preference. What kind of ally are you?
I know Unistoten had a hard time to get lawyers to represent them. That's one of the reasons we stepped up to do it, because we were, you know, we don't just work for Indian Act chiefs and councils. And if it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And particularly there with the Wet'suwet'en and with Delgamuukw, because you have the Delgamuukw decision. And if there's anyone where government, industry should be saying, we know who we need to talk to. We need to talk to the hereditary chiefs. We need to talk to them. It's them. Like, they got the decision. And what I do all the time, and when I teach here, when we teach Delgamuukw, I go, there's no Indian Act chief and council anywhere in this thing. It was brought by the hereditary chiefs. And so to now say, oh, we can just go talk to Indian Act chief and council, and we got their okay, so we're going to push the pipeline through. Like, that is such hypocrisy. That's the one where you can't have that.
Well,
I know you all want to, but I really feel like it's not worth it to put the money into
very good.
The lawyers. It's not.
They are hard.
Like, yeah. He's got a closet too. So.
All right.
Jesus.
Hey, before we all run, can we have a round of applause for Bruce?
Hey, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
How are you doing? Good, good. What's your class?
Property.
Property. Oh, nice. Brief pressure would be helpful.
Yes.
What have you just been doing?
Okay.
Like about the false.
Is there a class in here?
Oh, no.
Cool.